Welcome back to NeuroCore podcast show, where we explore the use of qualitative research methods in neurosurgery. Today, I have the absolute privilege of welcoming Dr. Victoria Clark to the show. Victoria is a chartered psychologist and an associate professor in qualitative and critical psychology at the University of West England in Bristol here in the UK. Victoria is a leading qualitative researcher and has written extensively on methodology, method, and specifically on thematic approaches with Virginia Brown from New Zealand. I defy anyone within the field of qualitative inquiry not to have heard of Brown and Clark's six stages of thematic analysis, more recently titled Reflexive Thematic Analysis. And today we will talk more about this reflexive approach and how it should be conducted. So Victoria, a very, very warm welcome to NeuroQual. Thank you for agreeing to do the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So we'll just start. I've done a small introduction, but would you like to introduce yourself and your journey to qualitative research?
My journey to qualitative research, I was thinking about this when I was lying in bed last night. I thought, where did it start? What's the beginning point? I think it's A-level sociology and learning about ethnographies. I still remember the street corner society ethnography, finding that really fascinating, and then also learning about the philosophy of science in A-level sociology. And so those two things, kind of learning about qualitative ethnographic research and then getting really fascinated by debates about philosophy of science, meant that when I got to undergraduate degree and there was lots of qualitative research on the curriculum, that it was just love at first sight. And I don't have a maths brain, and that's a real stereotype of qualitative researchers, that you do qualitative research because you can't do complicated statistics. And I can't do complicated statistics, but it's not it's a real love for quali. It's a draw rather than a kind of an escape from the stats. And as an undergrad, I learned about all kinds of stuff. There were lots of young feminist critical qualitative psychologists teaching on my degree program and kind of introducing us to their passions. So I learned about grounded theory, discourse analysis, conversation analysis, all different kinds of kind of qualitative approaches. We got to do a lab in grounded theory that was good fun, and I really enjoyed that. I think we looked at obituaries. Yeah, that was quite interesting. And then I did my undergraduate project. So my ambition at that point was to be a clinical psychologist. So I'd done a placement in a clinical psychology department in a big old, what used to be an old Victorian asylum, but still had a kind of clinical psychology and psychiatry department there. And I analysed family therapy sessions, kind of using discourse analysis. No doubt if I read it now, I'd be like horrified and go, that's really bad. But I really, really got into qualitative research. I was quite, I think when you're younger, you don't realize what you don't know and you don't realize how things are done. So I just randomly contact academic. I mean, this is the 1990s, so I just randomly phone people and say, oh, I've you know, I found your thesis in my university library and it's brilliant, and can I talk to you about your work? And and people were fantastic. I remember Anna Medill, psychology professor who did her PhD looking at counselling and therapy sessions, was incredibly helpful and supportive and kind, and sent me loads of papers and suggested work to me. So that's when the love became cemented. And then I decided to do a PhD at Loughborough University. And at the time, Loughborough was very much in the UK and probably globally a real centre for critical psychology. So I learned about discourse analysis and conversation analysis and discursive psychology, but also learned a real passion for methodology. So that early passion that came in sociology A-level and learning about philosophy of science was really kind of stoked at Loughborough, because everyone cared deeply about the methodological aspects of research. And so we'd have lots of weekly sessions where we'd look at data, but also sessions where we'd talk about different things. And so pretty much all my peers that I did my PhD with, they've written at least one paper on methodology, because I think that training instilled in us a kind of deep love of thinking about the techniques we use to do research, the values and the assumptions that drive our research. So that, you know, the how of research as well as the doing of research. And I think all that has come into the work Ginny and I do together. So although the professors we were surrounded by at Loughborough probably wouldn't be very impressed with what we're advocating for in qualitative research, what we've kind of outlined, because their approach was very different. But nonetheless, what they taught us, we've really kind of taken into what we do. And yeah, we try to instill in people, if not a love and a passion for the methodological aspects of research, at least a kind of willingness to think about it a bit, to not just kind of dive in and do, but to think about what it is that you're doing. So that's a very long introduction to me.
I think it's a really nice introduction, because what I hear from you, first of all, is just your love and passion for the discipline, and I feel that in your writing as well. That really comes across. And I think that to make qualitative engaging and interesting and worthy, you know, I think a lot of the people who listen to this show, it won't be a natural methodological choice, either because of how they've been disciplined, you know, because, you know, medicine and surgery is heavily positivistic. So a lot will be coming with kind of an intrigue and an interest, and trying to get that hook sometimes of drawing people in. And there is much more of an emphasis on the method and the doing. So just talk to a few people, get a few, you know, then get a few themes together, and that will do. And that's very different to let's talk methodology, let's talk about lenses, let's talk about theory, let's think about actually the depth and breadth and complexity of research. So just kind of unpicking that thematic, because that's quite often where, certainly what I hear from people who are either asking me to do maybe some quali work or themselves thinking about doing quali work, would be, okay, we don't really know enough about this, let's just have a chat with some people and we'll do a quick thematic analysis. So why do you think thematic, can you describe your own experience with thematic approaches and why you think thematic analysis is so popular?
Well, so Ginny and I first wrote about it in 2006, and we'd both been teaching it to our undergraduate students, and we'd just sort of been making it up as we went along, because there wasn't any really good thoroughly qualitative guidance about how to do what we wanted to do. I mean, obviously we had teaching materials that we'd inherited from colleagues and so on, and ways of kind of teaching for years within our particular departments, but there wasn't one good paper that you could give to students and say, this is what we're doing, have a read. And so Ginny was on sabbatical in the UK, and so we thought, well, why don't we have a go? Why don't we have a write? Why don't we just go to try and come up with something? And I think because it was fueled by a lot of experience and a lot of passion, the paper happened really quickly. So we did the bulk of work over a few days, and we took turns. So one was typing, the other was pacing, and then we'd flip and one would type and one would pace. And we really tried to unpack everything, because I think one of the things that's really challenging about qualitative research, if you're coming to it from a background of positivism and kind of scientific realism, is there's loads of kind of jargon, and then qualitative researchers just use it and assume everyone knows what they mean. And I think as a community, we're so used to using certain terms, we never actually stop to think, well, what does that mean when we talk about rich data, which everyone talks about rich data? What actually do you mean by rich data? Like, how do you know when a piece of data you're looking at is rich or not? How do you make that concrete judgment based on what you've got in front of you? So what we try to do in our writing is kind of really unpack what particular words and ideas meant. And we did okay with some things, but in other things we didn't. And we kind of added to the confusion, I think. So what we've been trying to do recently is kind of look at how our research has been, how our our approach has been used and try and unpack some of the assumptions that we made in writing about it for people so they understand a bit better what we were bringing to the table, but also to look at some problems in how it's used as well. So to look at some of the common problems in the published work that we see. And unfortunately, I think the approach you described, where we just have a chat with a few people and then bang out some themes, there's an awful lot of that around, and it doesn't make for brilliant qualitative research. And I think the other challenge, particularly in medicine, is that, and I think Lara Varpio makes this argument really well in relation to medical education, that what enabled qualitative research in medicine to kind of have some credibility is that it was presented to quantitative researchers in ways that were more palatable to them. So we have a really concrete concept like saturation that tells us when we've got enough data. And that sort of science sounds kind of nice and sciencey, you know, that we've achieved this thing, tick. And there are lots of other things and techniques and strategies that we can use that help people that aren't familiar with qualitative research understand it, but also be convinced that it's meaningful and valid. But unfortunately, I think a lot of those things come from positivism and they just don't serve qualitative research particularly well. So I'd say a lot of qualitative research, particularly in medicine, is this odd mashup of a bit of qualitative in the sense of qualitative techniques, but also qualitative values and assumptions and concepts, and then some kind of positivism and scientific realism. And it's all kind of stirred together. And it's this really kind of odd, unpleasant tasting cocktail that just doesn't work. And I think, you know, if you want to do scientific positivist qual, that's fine, but it's a very specific proposition. Whereas kind of properly or fully qualitative qual, so that's embedded in the values framework of qualitative research, as well as using these techniques, is very different. It's kind of, I don't know, it's so different from the way that we've been taught to think about what makes for good scientific quantitative research. And so it's, yeah, what Ginny and I are trying to do in our work is kind of get people more in that space, or at least to understand that there are these different spaces. There's the do qualitative research like a scientist, fine. There are versions of thematic analysis that will do that for you. Or you can do qualitative research and thematic analysis like a qualitative researcher, which is quite different. Where you don't want to be is in this odd space in the middle where you've kind of got a but in each camp and you're kind of doing a bit of both and it's all a bit of a mess. And it's not really, you know, it's not properly scientific because you've got some quali stuff floating around, but it's not properly quali because there's the positivism and the science kind of floating around. So having No, I mean, we literally just published a review of research using thematic analysis in health psychology journals, and we looked at a medically health journal, so Psychology, Health and Medicine, and it definitely published the worst quality research, and it definitely had that kind of messy, incoherent quality to it. And I think things like I think things like the CORIC checklist don't help, because that's quite popular in medical journals, and that again is, I mean, aside from all the issues with the methodology not being remotely replicable and deeply problematic, it's again a mess. CORIC is all over the place because it's got bits of qual and bits of positivism, and so it encourages people to produce this kind of incoherent research.
And I think one of the problems, or I think anyway, and certainly my kind of observations, are when people are trying to learn about this stuff, and they know, I mean, to be fair, you know, a lot of people I work with and have discussions with, they want to embrace qualitative research. You know, there is that, they can see its value. So at least, you know, we've won one war, you know, or one battle, and so they see the value, they'd like it done well, but they're still learning. They've still got a huge, and they've not been brought up with in the discipline. So is it easier that, you know, when you're trying to help people learn about stuff, you familiarize it in language that they are more understanding of? And then, I mean, maybe we just haven't gone far enough to say, well, this is like this, so you understand this concept now, but also we need to go that little bit further. Or do you just stay right at the beginning and say, actually, there's no parallels, this is completely different, and we need to start with from a blank slate? I mean, I guess my question is, how do you help somebody who's learning it from the first time, who is much more, you know, comfortable with a positivist lens, to see and to understand and to learn about the big quality, you know, quality research?
Yeah, I think it's really hard because you haven't been taught typically. I mean, I certainly wasn't when I had quant teaching and statistical teaching as an undergrad. I wasn't taught within the framework of, well, this is one way of doing research in psychology. It's the dominant way, and it has this set of values underpinning it, and it has this set of assumptions. It's like, let's do some research, let's do some stats. And then you've got the poor kind of quality lecturer going, well, you've kind of been taught that, and that's one way of doing things. Here are the values that underpin that, that they didn't teach you, but they're there nonetheless. And then we've got this whole different way of doing things that kind of looks like this. And it is my strong preference would be, and I don't, you know, it's one of those things that's never going to happen probably, is that when people are taught about research, they're taught about it as a particular way of doing things. And I just, because I think that's so helpful for you as a learner, because you understand straight away that there are other possibilities, that there are other kind of frameworks. And I think it's really hard because I think the stuff around the philosophy of science and the kind of stuff around, on, you know, those big scary words, ontology and epistemology, are really scary, and they are really difficult, and they are really challenging. But they're really important for you to have the deep, deep knowledge. Mm. But I think as well, just talking about theory for a long time can be really, really hard and really challenging, because I think what's really helpful as a qualitative researcher is being able to work with data and then understand the theoretical issues playing out in that work. Mm. So, for example, a lot of people will just make the common sense assumption that you interview someone about their experience, and the words that you capture are a way that you access that experience. So the words are a kind of route to, a reflective of someone's kind of lived experience. And that's such a common sense assumption. It's how we operate as human beings in the world, that if someone tells us something, they're kind of telling us about their experience, and their words kind of map onto that. But it is nonetheless a theoretical assumption about language and what it represents. And there are other people that think differently. There are other people that reject that view. So the discursive tradition that I was kind of trained in doesn't view language and words as merely reflective of kind of underlying experience. It views words as kind of active and doing things and bringing kind of realities into being. And I think until you know that there are other ways of thinking about things, it's really hard to see that you're making theoretical assumptions. You kind of need to know that there's other possibilities to see the assumptions that you're making. So I don't know how students feel about this, but I always do mention critical approaches to qualitative research, like discourse analysis, just so they're aware that there are other ways.
Yeah.
And that just because the assumptions they're making seem quite common sense and they fit onto how we think about language as human beings more broadly, it doesn't mean that you're not making theoretical assumptions. So I think it's sometimes that having that kind of point of comparison and going, well, in this framework we look at it this way, and in this framework we look at it that way, I think that can be quite helpful. And I really like, I organized an event a good few years ago now where Lucy Yardley, qualitative health researcher but also somebody who does quant as well, kind of, you know, made the point is, you know, I like my quantitative research to be quantitative and my quality to be qualitative. And they have different values frameworks and they have different standards and norms. And that's fine. I just need to know that when I'm over here, these are my assumptions and my values and my norms. And when I'm there, those are my assumptions and my values and my norms, and that I can switch, kind of switch between them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I do think it's really tricky if you've been schooled in one way to kind of learn that that is just one way and there are kind of other possibilities. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's no substitution for reading, talking to people, listening to lectures, and trying to wrap your head around it.
I think what you said was super helpful, actually. The quants to be quants and the quals to be quals, and I think that's a quite just in itself, I think that's quite a useful distinction. So we want to have a little bit more of a chat about about reflexive thematic analysis. So it's had a kind of like rebranding over the last few years. Can you tell us why you felt the need to retitle your approach to thematic analysis reflexive thematic analysis, and what the reflexive element means to it?
So it basically came about from having a better, I mean, we went to the library when we wrote our 2006 paper, we got every book there was on thematic analysis, we looked for stuff, but it, our primary goal wasn't understanding the world of thematic analysis as it existed. Mm. But it sort of become part of our kind of goal is to kind of understand where our approach sits in relation to other approaches, and to help people understand the different sort of approaches to thematic analysis that are out there. And I thought, well, we thought it's not very helpful that they're all called, well, lots of them are, there's other approaches like framework analysis and template analysis and matrix analysis, which have their own names, but they're nonetheless a form of thematic analysis. It's not very helpful that we've got lots of approaches using the same name. So let's give our approach a name that makes it distinctive, or at least signals the kind of school of approaches that it belongs to. And lots of people used Brown and Clark thematic analysis, which we hated because it felt so kind of egocentric. And we would have that, you know, we'd be writing something and I'd put Brown and Clark, and Ginny was like, no, we can't. It's just horrible. We can't call it after ourselves. We've got to call it something else. And so we had what is it about our approach that makes it distinctive? And so we settled on reflexive, and reflexive captures the way that the researcher has a role in producing knowledge, that everything that's involved in knowledge production will kind of shape it in some way. So the methods you use will have a role in the knowledge that's produced. You as a researcher will have a role. Your disciplinary norms and values will have a role in the knowledge that's kind of produced. And we thought, well, yeah, that works, because that captures the things we really want to highlight. We want to highlight the researcher's active role in the research process, that their subjectivity is kind of core to the process, and their subjectivity isn't a problem, that it's an inevitable, you know, when you're in quali land, things are subjective and that's okay. It's not that subjectivity is a problem. It's not that subjectivity is something to worry about. So I think terms like bias belong to that messy space that I mentioned in between quali land and quanti land, because bias implies a distortion of objective knowledge. And so it doesn't work in quali land because everything's biased, and so therefore nothing's biased because you can't all be biased. And concepts as well, like researcher influence, I think belong to that messy space, because it's like there's the research and then you're separate from it and you may influence it. You may kind of act on it. So I've read loads of dissertations where students kind of talk about the fact that their insider positioning or outsider position may have impacted on the research. It's like, no, you did impact. It's necessary. It's inevitable. And that's okay the thing is to reflect on how you think you did shape the process and share that with the reader. And it's not something to worry about or apologize for or try and control or bringing other coders or start calculating into coder agreement or using a code book and trying to kind of keep all this wild subjectivity kind of under control. It's kind of acknowledging that it's part of the process, that we're humans, that qualitative research is a very human undertaking. We're messy. Qualitative research is messy. And what we need to do is reflect on how we're messy and how we're kind of shaping what we do and how the end product is partly a communication of us. So reflexivity felt really important to kind of demark what we do, but also demarcate what we do, but also kind of separate it from other approaches, which, so there's a very kind of sciencey version of TA where you have multiple people coding the data and you use a coding frame that's fixed. And then you sort of use that as your fixed framework for organizing the kind of data into themes, and you look at the levels of agreement between coders, and you use statistical tests to do that to make sure that they're both coding the same bit of data in the same way. And then you can say, well, look, the coding's reliable and the coding's accurate because there's this really high level of agreement. And that probably seems quite appealing to people with a sciencey background. But when you start to unpick what's going on there, it's like, oh, you're missing so much. So to have a code book, the codes have to be quite broad because there's only so many codes that you can remember. So they're going to be quite broad. And one of my students memorably described them as sort of bucket codes or bucket themes, that you've just got a bucket, you've slapped a label on it, and you're just chucking everything in there that's kind of vaguely relevant to the topic. Mm-hmm. Whereas how we'd code in reflexive TA is there's no framework. There's no sort of agreement. You're just engaging with your data. You're thinking about it. You're asking yourself, what's going on here? What's relevant to the thing that I'm interested in? And how can I put a coding label on that that really captures what's going on and evokes what's kind of going on? So it's a very subjective kind of interpretive process, but that's okay. That's seen as how we can get good stuff to happen.
Yeah, and I think that, again, that's really helpful, that the idea, the comparison between reflexive thematic analysis and something like framework, or where you have like an a priori decision of, this is what we're going to look for, already decided at the start, we're going to look for that, and then we look for that, and other people might look for the same stuff, and we can agree that we found the same stuff, didn't we do well? And then you've got an answer that you pretty much already knew from the outset, you just have data to support your assumptions. Whereas what I love in reflexive thematic is the iterative kind of nature of the work with the data. So, you know, you might label something. And that's a very obvious distinction. A label or a code that you might use in one type of, you know, analysis, it's fixed. It always stays that. So that's how you get reliability between your coders. Whereas in reflexive thematic analysis, that code could change. So as you understand the data more and you understand what people are telling you more, and you can evolve your understanding with the data, and that leads, to my mind, leads to a much richer understanding of the data, and to go a place that the data is taking you, rather than to arrive at the destination that you had already planned. Is that a good kind of analogy?
Perfect. And I think it's what always disappoints us is when people use our approach, but the destination they arrive at is one that they could have arrived at with a more sciencey. So Linda Finlay, the counselling and psychotherapy researcher, calls it kind of scientifically descriptive TA, and whereas she calls reflexive approaches kind of artfully interpretive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really nice kind of image to have of the scientist versus the artist. Obviously, it's simplified and you can unpick it, but, you know, don't bother with our messy, complex, iterative, reflexive approach if you just want to do the sciencey approach, because it's the sciencey approach will take you there in a very straightforward way. Our approach has been set up to do something different. And so we always feel sort of frustrated when we see people using it to get to the kind of sciencey destination, because it's like, why would you bother? Why would you bother spend ages reading your data? Why would you bother kind of using our approach to coding, which is very kind of interpretive and inductive and subjective and reflexive, and when you could just do that more straightforward kind of structured approach? You know, why report themes that you could have reported at the start without doing any analysis using our approach? Because I think that's what's the kind of key distinction between different approaches, is the more sciencey approaches, you decide your themes at the start, and then you're using coding to basically organize the data into the thematic categories that you've come up with. In our approach, themes are where you kind of end, because you start your interpretive process through the coding and kind of breaking things apart. And then it's that breaking apart that helps you kind of put back things together into your themes. And your themes are about meaning, about the meaning within the data. And you're telling a story about that meaning. Whereas in scientific approaches, it's just categories. Mm-hmm. So it might be something like gender, and how gender, I don't know, the relevance of gender to a particular intervention or a particular experience. And here's everything the participant said about gender. That wouldn't work in reflexive TA, because you're not interested in categories. You're kind of interested in patterns of meaning. Mm-hmm. And you're telling the reader a story about those kind of patterns of meaning. And so it's a sort of an entirely different process. So this one, you kind of start with your themes. The sciencey one, you start with your themes. The reflexive TA, you end with them. And so if you just want to do the sciencey thing, do the sciencey thing. It's really straightforward. You know, people spending a lot of time and energy using reflexive TA to just come up with themes that they literally could have come up with before doing any analysis, doesn't seem worthwhile.
And I think that's why it's important to understand your research question or the aims of your investigation, because qualitative, I mean, it's a whole toolkit of stuff, you know. So you can, you know, you wouldn't, I'm rubbish with analogies, but you wouldn't use a hammer to change a car wheel. You know, you have to find the right tool. And if you only want to go to a place where you've got a pretty reasonable idea where you're going to go, then you need something that will take you there. And if you want to do something which is much more explorative and interpretive, or you want to do something a bit different, a bit critical, or different kind of theoretical lenses, then you have a tool for that, and that will take you to a different place. And that's what's so exciting about qualitative methods, and what makes it so difficult to write about, because as soon as you think about one thing, you're like, you can think of a million reasons why it wouldn't be right for a different type of approach. But so thinking about what is right and what is wrong, what would you say would be advice for people either doing or writing up a reflexive thematic in it? What do you love to see in someone who's professed to use reflexive thematic analysis? And when do you kind of put your head in your hands and think, oh, wish they hadn't done that, or I wish I hadn't seen that?
I think it's really tricky, because when you're reporting, if you're reporting in a journal article, it's not just about you. It's about the reviewers, it's about the editors, and it's about what the journal will allow you to do. And I recognize I'm on a hiding to nothing here, but medical journals, the typical formats really constrain how qualitative research can be reported. They're often very short. If the data's there, it's in tables, kind of separated from the interpretive commentary, which makes sense for quant. You have your stats and you have your interpretation of them separately. It doesn't really work for qual. And so it sort of makes doing qualitative analysis in an authentic way harder. But I think in terms of what researchers can do, and again, this is a challenge if you're publishing in medicine, is to give a sense of who you are as a person. I really like methods sections written in the first person, so you have a sense that a human being did the research. The research just, it didn't sort of passively happen and you were there along the way, that you did it, that you made these decisions, that you made these kind of choices. And this is why you did the things you did. So a little bit of kind of rationale and explanation. Where things can feel a bit disappointing is where people just kind of recite, I followed the six phases of Brown and Clark and these were what they are. And it's like, well, okay, but how? What exactly did you do? Tell us about it, how you engaged with the process. And if you tweaked it and changed it and made it your own, kind of tell us about that. So give us a kind of lively sense of what it is that you did. I mean, one of my students in her thesis spoke in a method section about coding in cafes and how the shift in physical space kind of shifted her sort of orientation and the way she kind of engaged with the data. And it was just this lovely sentence of, yeah, that's really interesting. That gives me a really kind of lively sense of your process and what you did. You know, she could have just said, I followed these steps, but instead it was a real sense of how I engage with the process. So I think when we offer up our sort of six phase process, it is a sort of an invitation rather than a you should do this exactly. Mm-hmm. It's here's an idea of how you might systematically go about analyzing data. We've given it a lot of thought. There's a good rationale for why we suggest you do what you do, but it's not something, you know, it's not compulsory. It's not like the assumption around baking that you have to kind of follow recipes precisely. I mean, you don't. I've known from a young age you don't, because my grandfather was a chef and I used to bake with him and he'd never weigh anything and everything was beautiful. And it's because he understood the process. He understood the chemistry of baking and how different ingredients impact each other. And he had lots of experience. And I think good qualitative research is like how he baked, in the sense of you really get it, you really understand it, you know how things work, and you're working from a values base. So what really matters is the values rather than the procedures, because you can still follow our procedures and still do something that's rubbish. You know, they don't come with a quality stamp on them. So what really matters is your qualitative sensibility, your values as a researcher, and that you bringing those to the table and being guided by those and telling us when you write up how you engage with the process. I mean, there isn't room in conventional reports, but there are some papers I really love. One by Lisa Trainer, who's a PhD student, about her reflexive TA process. There's another one, I'm not going to remember the name of the authors because middle-aged forgetful brain, about foreign domestic helpers, I think in China. And the author's just detailing how he got from this fairly pedestrian analysis to something more complex. You know, and I thought about this and this provoked me to think about this and I reflected on that. And those are really lovely because they give you a real sense of how people got from where they started to kind of where they ended up. So even if it's just little glimpses of that in a report, it's nice to see a sense that a human being conducted the research, not a robot. And I think if you're able to work from a values base, then you can reflect on things as well. Because I think the problem with qualitative research is you've got lots of people telling you X or Y is really good. So you must say you've saturated your data or your themes. It's really good to check the findings with your participants. Member checking or participant validation, it's really good to say that you kind of triangulated your data sources, and loads of people will tell you that those things are good, and people do them because someone said this is really good, you must do this. But if you're operating from a values base, you pause and you think, okay, so let's think about this concept of saturation. What's going on in this concept? Let's have a see if someone's written about it. Oh, yes, they have. What have they got to say? And you work through it and you reason through it and you work out if it works for your research or if it doesn't. So it's what we call knowing practice, in the sense of you're thinking about things, you're being deliberative, you're reflecting on things. You have a sense of what your research values are as a qualitative researcher, and you're trying to do things that are coherent and consistent with those values. And it's quite different from just sitting down and following, you know, someone's procedures. Procedures are obviously important and procedures reflect values, but the values are what's key, and what's key as well is what who you are as a researcher, having an understanding of what your values are, reflecting on what appeals to me. Do I like the sciencey descriptive type of TA? Am I the kind of creative artist kind of being more interpretive? What speaks to my values? And trying to kind of act from those values. I think we get in a pickle when we try to follow procedures without thinking about the values that underpin them, or we do things because someone tells us this is a good thing to do. Sorry, that's a very long answer to your question.
No, it's not at all. I just had loads of follows. I'm trying to remember all the things I wanted to talk about. The first one was the bit about researchers being robots, and it just came to mind, the idea that when you were talking about papers that you loved, your face lit up, which our listeners wouldn't be able to see. But there is a sense that the reader of research, the consumer of research, isn't a robot either. And good quality research resonates. Sometimes it leaves you with an uncomfortable feeling of, you know, checking in with yourself, making you think about your practice, and that's where another layer of interpretation is happening, you know, and that's what, you know, when you've read a good paper, you kind of, sometimes you're exhausted, you're like, that's not because it's a marathon, because it's, you know, it's a long piece of work, sometimes they are, but it challenges you on a deeper level than, you know, a table of results. And the other thing that I wanted to just reflect with you was the analogy of baking. So I often use baking analogies in research with my students, and I think you're right that if you just base quality on methods, it's like sticking a novice baker in a kitchen with a whole load of ingredients and saying, make me a cake. They might make something that resembles a cake, but, you know, possibly might not taste very nice, won't look like what it's supposed to. But with, you know, education, you know, experience, recipes are great to start with and to understand chemistry and process and what things can be put together. And then the experiment, you know, the magic then happens. Well, if I just change this bit of ingredients, I wonder what happens. And then it's the learning that comes. And that's very similar, I think, in research methods, that you need the basics to understand what you're doing. And then that leads to the confidence to be creative and understand how what you have done has then changed the product of what you end up with. I don't know if you wanted to comment on any of that.
Yeah. I mean, to your first point about the reader of research, I mean, I can remember back in October last year marking dissertations, and I'm our dissertation module leader, so I cherry pick. I naughtily give myself the gift of ones I want to second mark, and there was one I wanted to second mark because I thought it would be really good based on the ethics application, and it was a beautiful piece of work. It was about, I'm not going to be able to remember the name of the specific medical condition, but it was about parents' views on the role of music in the lives of their children with this very rare medical condition that meant that they had very limited capacities for communication. And it was so compassionate, and it gave such a vivid sense of the parents that I cried when I read it, because I could feel myself welling up now, because it was so beautiful. It was so moving. And that's what really exceptional qualitative research does, I think. Like you say, it can make you feel really uncomfortable. It can make you question yourself, or it can move you, because it gives you a real sense of people's kind of lived experience and what something's like for them, what it's like to be them. And it does it with kind of compassion. And that's a very different way of thinking about research, I think, because, you know, if we're trained in the kind of scientific model, there's no passion there. It's supposed to be kind of dispassionate and neutral and objective. But really good qualitative research is about emotions. I think it does kind of engage you emotionally. It might make you feel really uncomfortable. And I know I've certainly written things that have made reviewers feel really uncomfortable, to the extent that they've thought they've read things in the paper that they haven't. So I wrote a paper based on an experience of wearing a Stonewall t-shirt in the classroom. So it's a long time ago, and it was a slogan that Stonewall have used for years, but it was when the slogan first came out that some people are gay, get over it. And it was when they were campaigning for gay marriage, and students hated it. They hated the t-shirt. They hated me for wearing it in a lecture. They were really angry. They thought I'd accused them of being homophobic. And being me, I thought, oh, this is interesting. And I did a survey and I collected their views, and I wrote a really reflective paper. Well, I wrote two really reflective papers about the incident and what happened and what was going on. And in the second longer paper that I wrote, I didn't mention anything about my sexuality at all, really deliberately. And every single reviewer had commented about the fact that I'd come out in the paper when I very deliberately hadn't. And they'd seen that in there because the paper had made them really uncomfortable. And that's where I think qualitative research can be really fascinating as well, as if it, yeah, leads you to reflect on your assumptions and how you do things, and it can leave you feeling really kind of disquieted. And so I had a little section at the end of the published paper kind of reflecting on the fact, I haven't told you this, I haven't given you this information, but you've probably nonetheless read it into the paper because, you know, certainly everyone that reviewed it did. That's where I think qualitative research can be really wonderful. And I've completely forgotten what your second point was. Sorry. So I'm kind of on an emotional journey with qualitative research.
The other one was about baking and putting people in a kitchen just with a whole bunch of ingredients. But
I mean, I think that's how we've described our approach as well. It's a kind of, it's a get you started approach, not in the sense that you'll go off and do other things, but you might. But we're trying to be really explicit and clear and accessible to help you get started. And then as you become more confident, the process kind of changes. I mean, Ginny and I were doing some work together over the summer, and we're like, oh my God, what if people saw our process? They'd think it was so terrible. But it's because we're really experienced and, you know, we've done it a lot. We do it a lot with students. And so we do it differently. We don't rigidly kind of follow our steps. It's really messy. But that's because we're experienced. So we're sticking to the ethos of the approach we outline, but not the rigid kind of procedures.
So I just wanted to kind of wrap things up now. I could talk to you all day, but I'm sure you have better things to do. So what advice would you give to anyone in neurosurgery considering to use reflexive thematic analysis?
I would find some good reflexive thematic analysis to have a read of, to get a really good sense of what good reflexive TA looks like. So ask someone you trust who is really knowledgeable about reflexive TA and say, can you give me some examples to have a look at? So I have a sense of what I'm aiming for, that this is what the good end product kind of looks like. I think that's really helpful. Then I think you've got to do a lot of reflection on who you are as a person and who you are as a researcher, what your values are, what you've been trained in, how that shapes how you see the world. So, sorry to do a plug for my book, but our book that we've written on thematic analysis that came out last year, well, technically came out at the end of 2021, but it's dated 2022. Mm-hmm. The first chapter is all about reflexivity, and there's sort of exercises to kind of get you started. Mm-hmm. So who you are as a researcher, what your values base is, what your positioning is, and how that is going to shape how you engage in research, how that will shape how participants, if you have them, kind of view you, interact with you, what assumptions they make about you. You know, all that process of reflection, I think, is really important to kind of do at the start. And I think in reflecting on that stuff, it will inevitably start to take you on the journey towards qualitative land, because sciencey land won't encourage you to kind of reflect on those things. It will kind of encourage you to be more neutral and dispassionate and see yourself as kind of removed from the process. So I think that reflexivity work is really important. And it's also, important to recognize that reflexivity isn't kind of a destination, that it's an ongoing journey, that you're always kind of reflecting on your assumptions. Mm-hmm. And talking to other people about your research is really helpful, because they will hold up a lens that will enable you to kind of see things in a slightly different way. So one of my PhD students is doing her PhD on fan fiction, which is great. And I was talking to a friend of mine about it, who's a massive romance fiction fan and can tell you everything you need to know about the romance genre. And she was kind of reflecting certain things to me that were really useful, because I'm not huge on that genre in the way that she is. Mm. And she was talking about kind of the tropes and the narratives of that form of fictional writing. And it was really useful to kind of take back into my students' kind of dialogue with her data. So talk to other people. I think that's really helpful. If you're working on your analysis, talk to other people, share your ideas. That I find, I always talk to people about what I'm doing, because I think it's really, that helps me kind of organize my thoughts. Recognize as well that it's not quick and dirty, that it takes time. That you can't, you know, power through your coding in a few days. You need to put it down, you need to think about it, you need to kind of come back to it. So it's not a process for uber efficient delivery of results. It's the analogy we used in our first attempt at the podcast, we kind of a slow cooker versus a pot noodle, and I think that's a really good way to think about it, because you need to think, you need to kind of mull it, you need to kind of reflect on your assumptions and how you're seeing things. And I've got a project ongoing at the moment with students looking at disability in clothing, and it sort of stems from my own experience of becoming disabled and kind of thinking about the clothes I wear. But the doing of the research has helped me reflect on my own experience and my own assumptions, and hearing other people's accounts enables me to reflect on how I make sense of things. So yeah, lots of space for reflecting and pondering, I think, is really important. So they're not very practical, concrete things, and I apologise for that.
But I think they are, though. I think they are very practical things. And I just want to give your book a proper plug, which is here. So Thematic Analysis, a Practical Guide, and that's with Sage. And that is out at the moment. I recommend it to anybody. Read it myself, I think that's probably a good place to kind of wrap things up. But I think that we've done loads of metaphors today. I'm definitely buying a season ticket to Qualiland. I hope to see you there, and as many other neurosurgery researchers that we can take along on the rides with us. That would be great. But I've found that fascinating today, so helpful. I think loads of practical advice. I'm just really, really privileged, like I said at the beginning, to have you with us today. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And if you go on our website, www.thematicanalysis.net, there are all our resources that we've created are there. So it's a good place to start. So there's links to lectures, webinars, all kinds of stuff. So yeah, we do as much as we can to kind of create resources to kind of help people with their journey to hopefully Qualiland.
Really, really helpful resources. Thank you again.
Thanks.